You're about to listen to a new episode of the Redefining Cybersecurity Podcast with Sean Martin. Have you ever thought we're selling cybersecurity insincerely, buying it indiscriminately, and deploying it ineffectively? Well, perhaps we are. Let's look at how we can organize a successful information security program that integrates business culture with people, process, and technology to drive growth and protect business value.
Hello, everybody. You're very welcome to a new Redefining Cybersecurity Podcast here on ITSP Magazine, or more specifically, a new episode of the CISO Circuit Series with my good friend, Michael Piacente. How are you, Michael?
Good. Good to see you, Sean.
Yeah, good to see you, too. And we have a distinguished guest today, Betsy, and I'll let you do the honors. But for many, many who know the show, I get to talk with all kinds of cool people. And Michael, no, I'm kidding. And now where we look at the role of cybersecurity in business and the roles in cybersecurity that enable the programs in the business. And for me, the ultimate goal is to operationalize technology, operationalize security programs, and enable the business to grow and succeed successfully, safely, I should say. And it's not an easy task, especially with a lot of the pressures of attacks and threats and compliance that keeps coming up and all the work associated with that. And I think other parts of the business. So the role doesn't stand on its own, right? We work with other teams, and we're going to talk a little bit about the relationship between the CIO and the CSO/CISO. So Michael, any thoughts you want to share to kick things into gear?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a huge convergence going on between these two functions. I feel like it comes up in literally every day of my conversations, both with CISOs and CIOs, but also with clients. And what are the functions? How are they dissected? A lot of it depends on the size and shape of the company, the industry, where they are in their journey. So we certainly can double click on that. And I think Betsy has probably the best perspective, having done it before, having talked to many companies in that space. So I'm excited to hear her perspective.
So. Yep. And so for those who don't know Betsy, maybe a few words from you about some of the things you've worked on and what you're up to now, and what prompted you to join us for this. I'm honored to have you on.
Anyway, thank you so much, Sean and Michael, for hosting me. I've been looking forward to this ever since Michael floated the idea. So starting off with your first question, just about my background, it's been a little bit over 20 years, which sounds crazy saying that because it's been a wild ride. But I started off working, as many people in security did when we were coming up, that's how I refer to it as, in the data center, and help desk. So that was my background. At the time, when I went to school in Buffalo, New York, I'm originally from Nairobi, Kenya, went to school in Buffalo, New York. I was on a path when I was in Kenya to be a lawyer, but I fell in love with computers. And I'm so glad I did, because, you know, things ended up working out as they have today. And so started off data center work, help desk work, cable industry. And then I met a professor who was, I went to a Jesuit college in Buffalo, New York, Nairobi to Buffalo. And she was doing moonlighting work with the FBI on cybercrime. And she introduced a course in cybersecurity. And the moment I took one of her classes, I knew that that was it. I knew that this was exactly what I wanted to do with my life. And so, you know, fast forward, it was difficult to find jobs in security because the role, even today, is still in its early stages. Spent some time, you know, living in Buffalo, New York. I worked in a number of industries, healthcare. I was in an insurance company. That's actually where I got my first CISO role, was a health insurance company. And then, you know, I was born in the tropics. I'm solar powered, I like to tell people. And so after 10 years of Buffalo winters, you know, by then I was married and I looked at my husband, and I said, I think it's time for us to try a different environment where I don't hibernate during the winter or dig out of snow. And so we went out west. And this was after, remember the housing crisis. So it wasn't very clear. It was a very uncertain time. And that's, you know, we sold our house and then just moved into an apartment because it was still the West Coast and we just didn't know what was going to work out, whether it was going to work out. So I went to work at eBay. I was running their risk program, eBay. And PayPal were still together at that time. And I had a really interesting role. So eBay and PayPal had grown by M&A. And by the time I got there, they had about 35 little companies all over the world that they had acquired. And the security posture in each one of these was sort of like very opaque. And so I was brought in to build out a standard by which you could measure out the security risks for all of these. They called them adjacencies at the time. Loved that job, got to meet and work with many amazing people. And then Facebook came calling. And from there, you know, I think that's where I learned the most about what it means to build a security program in a high threat environment. And so think of everything. By the time I joined Facebook, I think we were looking at the monthly active users. I forget, maybe it was around 600,000 monthly active users. By the time I left, it was over 1.2 billion. You know, they had acquired WhatsApp, Oculus. And I got to be on the front lines of watching and building out security capabilities for some of these acquired companies. So at Facebook, I ran the security assurance program, which is basically all of the SOC 2 work, any of the things that fell between regulatory work and technology work. So that was really cool. And then towards the end, I worked on operations, which is I run a team of program managers and anything that security team was involved in, we had our hands in. We were sort of like the nucleus of the security team. And so after that, after I spent about 4 years there, I started thinking about moving. My husband and I started thinking about moving back east because our families are all located here. You know, people are getting older. We by then had two children and we looked at each other and said, what are we doing? We love the West Coast, but it's time to go back east. And I said, you know, New York is a really interesting place to go. I'm interested in fintech. And it's funny, I did not get into fintech right away. I got into a health insurance, not health insurance, a medical device company that was digitizing ultrasound. You would connect, and the company's name is Butterfly, and they have a really cool product where you literally connect an ultrasound probe onto an iPhone, and you as a doctor out in the field don't have to wait for a bulky machine. And so, you know, to me, that was sort of the best interaction of you're helping, you're finding a product that is helping to change lives, as well as having all of these complex problems because you have regulation, you've got hardware security, you've got, you know, there's a cloud backend, you've got AI. Nobody was talking about AI back in, then as they are today, but all of these things were coming together. And I thought, wow, this is a really interesting company. So I was there, helped them build out their security program, their IT program. And then I got this incredible opportunity to build out another security function, this time in blockchain and crypto, and that was Chainalysis. So I wrapped up my time at Chainalysis in January. And now what I'm doing is advising startups. I also co-founded my own startup doing incident response in primarily East Africa, although we're starting to see some interest in the U.S., with more smaller shops. So that was a long drawn out way, but I hope you got sort of like the story of where we, you know, how I got to where I am today.
Betsy, by the way, I've sort of heard bits and pieces of a story. I've had the pleasure of knowing Betsy for about 7 years, I think, 6 or 7 years. I love that story. It's just such an inspiring story. First of all, a couple of things I wanted to point out. First of all, Betsy's first CIO role, I believe it was with the healthcare company. It was like one of the first HMOs, right, yeah, in New York. That was only about 5 or 6 years into your career, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yes, very accurate. Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
for those out there, you know, a lot, and I work with a lot of folks whose end goal is to be the CISO, and sometimes it comes later in the career, sometimes it comes earlier. And in Betsy's case, it came earlier. You know, the opportunity is there, and she took the most, you know, took the most of the opportunity and really built upon her career in a totally different industry. And then was able to pivot into basically, you know, to eBay and PayPal, which is a very different industry, but probably equally or maybe as not, you know, governance wise, be able to. So everything, every step along the way with Betsy, she used previous experience and then grew. And I always thought, I always looked for that from a candidate perspective, from a leader perspective. It's actually a wonderful story. The other thing that that I will give you the humble pie piece on is that, you know, at Facebook, you were pretty much one of the leaders under Alex Damos and that team. That's kind of how I met you and heard about you and your amazing reputation, your humanity. And so that was a massively, that was probably the one of the largest scaled environments on the planet at that time, if not the largest. So I just love to kind of get your thoughts. Like, what's, when you're working at a FANG at that level, at that time, is there some nuance in surviving and working and growing yourself during that time that you, any experiences that you could take away from that you wanted to share?
That's a great question. And thank you for putting it the way you did, because you made me sound like, you know, this genius who was very strategic, but in reality, it was a number of just steps and people. You know, I think I can't underscore, there are people who took, I call it, they took a risk on me, because going into the Bay Area, you know, I was only about 3 years into eBay when Facebook came calling. And so it was, you know, at that time, most people in security were not thrilled with the idea of a Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. I just want to put that out there, because, and it's for all of the reasons that we still, you know, worry about today, where there's just a lot of data, personal data that we're sharing. And so there was all sorts of things that went into that decision to join Facebook. But your question was around, how do you survive or thrive in that situation or in an environment like that? And it really goes down to the culture. You know, before Alex and I, great friends, there was Joe Sullivan, also another friend of mine. I think they built an environment in which we knew that the work that we were doing was difficult, but we also knew the work we were doing was having an impact. And you know, there's tons of really great stories that have come out of that security team. The other thing is the innovation. You know, I sat next to a number of people who just created tools. They were hobbyists, so they would create these security tools, and they were beautiful. They were you know, very elegant. So we had something called SecurityBot, where if data was being accessed, maybe there were some issues and there was a red flag that somebody was accessing this data, SecurityBot would pop up and, you know, and interact with you. These are things that today, you know, we're seeing more and more of that being built out. But at the time at Facebook, there were people who were just so talented and so passionate and were able to just create or invent really elegant solutions to security, and understanding that we had to lean on our partners. It wasn't just a, you know, security team versus the entire organization. No, we ended up building lots of really strong relationships. I ran a program called Hacktober, which was, I would say, probably one of the best marketing tools for the security team at Facebook. Mm-hmm. And I've taken that playbook into other companies where, you know, at Chainalysis, I created Cryptober, which is a riff on Hacktober. But the idea is, you know, you create a fun environment during Cybersecurity Awareness Month, And it's not just about phishing people and making people embarrassed, you know, that they clicked on a link. You know, at Facebook, it was interesting things like leaving USB sticks just around the campus. It was movie nights, you know, bringing in, you know, people could bring in their families and giving away swag. It was just, we created a really great culture and environment where people felt comfortable raising security issues with us. You know, we had different channels where people could reach out to us if they suspected something, and built that idea of a partnership versus a, sometimes you can have, and I'm not saying that, you know, it was all roses the entire time, but at least when you can connect to people on that level, on that human level, you're here, you know, I respect, I empathize what you're doing. Here's what we're trying to do. Let's figure out a way to make this work. And so I think a lot of that, those lessons that I picked up, from Facebook, made it such that, yes, the environment was tough. It was very busy, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
That's great. Yeah. And by the way, one thing I just learned about you is you're really good at the marketing of names. When I come up with a product, they're like terrible, terrible. Like where did I even come up with that? So Cryptober is pretty awesome.
Thank you. Maybe I'll go into marketing with this.
Yeah, hey, I'm with you on that. I now know who to call when I have a good idea, but no idea.
Anytime.
Yeah. But it is true. I mean, you know, one thing for people like take away from this is, you know, it's not so much always about the company that you work for that you're helping to build a security organization, but the security culture in that company is what also drives your own personal growth, but also drives your ability to make your management track or your architecture track, whatever it is, because the enablement of that culture is key. And you worked for two of the more extraordinary security programs in the world. You know, eBay is widely known as a, you know, CISO factory to the extent, and CIO factory, as is Facebook, and the extraordinary people, Joe and, you know, Alex and call friends as well. And they're amazing. And so it's pretty fantastic to see that. And then you being able to take that and apply those lessons learned, the mistakes that everyone made, and then the growth opportunities into your own organizations when you're building out Butterfly and Chainalysis. So it's a really cool story and a unique one. So
thank you.
Yeah, neat. Sorry, Sean, I'm capitalizing.
No, this is fantastic. As you were describing some of your journey, I was thinking, that's a story on its own. That's a story.
we could go down many rabbit holes.
I want to maybe go to this point of, I'm going to stick with the culture, because did it exist, the culture, or was it something that you helped shape? Because I can't recall a time when somebody said the security tool was beautiful. Right. And it's something that they created, and they had the freedom to do those things. And if anybody listening to the show is listening to this episode, they'll realize that many times I'll say, when is security going to have its transformational moment? When can it shine as a place where it actually drives business value? And if the team feels good and the tools coming from it are good and the programs are operating in it within it are good, I think it has to be good for the organization. So my question is, the culture that allowed the team to be creative and be innovative and feel good about the work that they're doing, did that exist? Does that help? Did you help shape it? How did that come around?
That's a great question. How did it come around? So I joined Facebook in 2011, and part of the onboarding process, if I'm thinking, you know, it feels like it was forever ago, but sometimes these memories come back to me. And I remember there were no restrictions once you got into the company about where your passions and where you could spend your time. So, and what I mean by that is, when you're going through onboarding, especially as an engineer at Facebook, and I don't know if it's the same for other of these FANG companies, but you go through something called bootcamp. And the idea there is like for you to learn, because it's a massive code base, you know, so they just don't throw you into the wolves, but you have to go through this process. But, you know, and depending on what role you are or you were going into, you had a, you know, a few different paths, but there were some things that were very specific and they were around some of the actual Facebook culture itself. So I think, and that culture itself is just, you know, around the word hacking was thrown around a lot, but not hacking in the security sense. It was finding a better way to do something, you know, being more efficient, being more effective, and not being afraid to do it. So you would walk around the campus and there would be posters. What would you do if you were not afraid? That's a big one by Sheryl Sandberg. And I think people really lived those values. So we essentially took the company values and infused them into the security program so that we wouldn't look, because, you know, depending on the industry you're in, the security team can sometimes, you know, it can sometimes feel like you're isolated because you're holding your hand up saying, no, let's put the brakes on this. But if you then, you know, flip that on its head and say, no, we're just like the entire company. We also like to hack. We also like to build things. And that just gave people the courage, I guess, that they needed to go out and get creative. And also performance review processes also had a place to play here where you were rewarded on the impact that you had. So that word was everywhere. You know, I'm starting to remember some posters on the wall, you know, fix more and whine less. You know, so that was just the environment. If you find something that's broken, you know, figure it out. Another example I'll give you is, I had got to, there were opportunities, if you were interested, where you could go and work on other teams. And so I decided, when Facebook was rolling out, internet.org, which is, was a very bold idea to get the entire world connected. But that's the kind of environment that, you know, these companies are built in, but, they were, expanding into Kenya, into East Africa. And, you know, I'm from Kenya. And I created a pitch. I went to the growth team. And I said, I want to learn how you're building partnerships, how you, you know, grow and scale out products on the ground. Spoke to my manager and he said, yeah, that sounds great. Go do that. And I went and did that for 6 months. This stuff doesn't happen in your, you know, everyday company. And I know that what I'm describing is sort of like, you know, the perfect case where you have so much talent and you can move people around where the interests take them, and yet you still have the operations going, right? That some of the bigger consulting companies will do that. But it's not easy to do for every company, but the ones that figure out how to do it, I think sort of like build that into their DNA, and that's where the creativity starts to show up.
Go ahead, Michael.
Oh, I was just going to mention from a recruiting perspective, I guess, as the simplest way to say it. We've had the opportunity to work with things and also recruit out of them. And, you know, this idea of culture around building and fixing and hacking is really, truly special. And there's so many companies that try to replicate that at, you know, at their own scale. But I mean, I don't think people realize the general consumer of knowledge don't realize how important the FANG culture is, Facebook very much included. And you know, we have products that were built because those companies exist.
Absolutely.
I mean, we have processes that are built because those companies exist, because no one had ever seen anything that dynamic at scale before. There was nothing like it in the corporate environment. And so it's really, I mean, that is why the Silicon Valley is the Silicon Valley, has a lot because of these companies, you know, eBay is being the first of them. Mm-hmm. And then they, you know, move on from there. The Ciscos of the world where they're, you know, it's just amazing when you start looking at I'm a history major, I'm a dork around that. So I'm such a history nerd, but I love that aspect of it. And you really now see it with, leaders like Betsy and those that even before her and after, coming from those environments, are really uniquely set up in a totally different mindset. So I just wanted to point that out. So
it's interesting that you say that, because when you're going through, you know, when you're in those roles and those environments, it's just what you do. That's exactly. The job. That's the culture. It's only when you leave and maybe you go to another, in my case, another you know, city and another company, and then you go, wow, that was a really interesting and special experience. And you know, now, you know, it's been many years since I was at Facebook. We're probably, you know, hitting year 8, 9. But I still have very fond memories. I still have connections with people there. And sometimes we will talk and say, out here in the real world, you know, nobody is doing X, you know. I think a lot of people actually struggle when they leave these fangs where you have custom built tooling, because for a long time, it took me a while to learn AWS because Facebook had its own cloud infra, internal cloud, right? Or even just some of like your very basic tools like Slack, which now, you know, everyone uses, but Facebook had Workplace. And it took me a long time to figure out how to operate outside of the environment where things were, what's the word, homebrew or you know, custom made for that environment. It can be a really interesting, sometimes challenging experience.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me to watch how that transpires. So, sorry, Sean, I kind of cut you off there.
No, this is a fascinating conversation. And the one thing that I'm curious about, because you touched on it a bit in the performance reviews, is I often think, well, if you're going to, a lot of companies, and we mentioned marketing earlier, right? Marketing today has become not so much about how we present ourselves. I'm talking security vendors here primarily. Not so much how we present ourselves to the market. It's how many leads can we generate and how do we measure that? And I think security generally, I'm generalizing here, but security has become some of that as well. How do we measure things to the fine point of technology and data? Are our teams successful? And in your example, it may not directly relate to fewer attacks, fewer breaches, quicker time to respond, less downtime. I don't know maybe it does. And then that's kind of my question. How do you support that culture and enable that creativity and innovation and being part of the organization, not separate from it, and also demonstrate in some way that you're successful?
Yeah, that's a big question. And I think it plagues a lot of us in security. You know, it's a very recurring conversation. You know, you mentioned Sean, you're in a number of security groups. It's the, what are we sharing with our board? You know, what are you managing? What sort of metrics are you looking at the team level, at the org level, department level? And so I don't know if there's no one, you know, one size fits all. Going back to the whole performance piece, I think there's work that is just keep the lights on. We know that we have to do, you know, whether it's vuln management or some of the products like processes, there's work that is just, it just has to be done. It's keep the lights on. And then there's the transformative work, which is the 2-3 years from now, you know, we're going to need this thing. So I'm going to spend some time thinking about it now. And sometimes depending on the size of a team, depending on the environment or the whether it's highly regulated, you know, it could be that you don't have enough time to focus on those strategic things. But those are the more transformational initiatives. And so I think we in security live in this constant, you know, sometimes I call it like a Tasmanian devil, where I'm just going around, going, oh, this thing happened, and that thing happened, that thing happened, and it's hard to block out all that noise and say, you know, our head of sales said we're going to expand into this geographic market, and here are some of the challenging issues that we might face. And just having to build that time. So as a leader, I spent most of my time trying to help the team focus on what are the 2 to 3 things we need to get right now, highly prioritize those. And then let's not burn ourselves out on these other red herrings. And there's plenty of them in security. You know, you have to do it every morning. If you open up your Slack or open up your browser, there's been so many stories and that can really start to wear on you. So half the battle is just going, you know, yeah, this stuff is happening over here. It's not really a big of a deal. And it's hard to sometimes draw the line, because in security, everything can go from being a small issue to blowing up. Sometimes it's perception, sometimes it's real. And so it really, you have to have that stomach to say, no, I don't care that we don't have this tool implemented right now. We're going to focus on identity and access management, because that's the most important thing we have to get to, we have to get right today. And it's a constant reframing. So we used to joke when I was at Chainalysis that we would, you know, do annual planning, but it was really, you know, it was, let's look at the next, you know, month or two, and then reassess and constantly keep in communication about what we need to focus on and deliver on.
Monthly annual planning.
Yeah.
Basically.
By the way, to translate that, but that was great, Betsy. It's great insight. This is the superpower of the CISO and to the CIO to an extent, right? It's being so confident and knowing the muscle memory so well of the blocking and tackling items that are your day job, that you can focus in on orchestrating, getting the right level of resources, right level of detail, so that you can actually focus on those red herrings in a way that you can provide digestible data back to the decision makers for impact to occur on the other side of it. So it's like, you're so strong and so able-bodied and confident on fixing the 70%, that focus now is on the 30% of the things that come at you and you have to figure out a business solution to it. That's the sign of an incredible CISO. It's where most people struggle. They focus on the first part first, and they get things overcomplicated. And then the business is like, I don't understand what you're trying to do. I have all these other big things I'm trying to solve, but you're focused on these things. And I hear this complaint all the time. I think it's just, it's really fun to hear it, kind of regurgitated back from, you know, this is how a CISO succeeds. So for those listening out there, this is how it works.
I think that's an interesting observation you had there. The way I think of it is, it's like when you're an invest. If, I don't know if people listening are into. I watch a lot of CNBC Talking Heads, but it's almost what if you have a thesis, right, about what you're going to invest in, then it's very easy to block out the noise. You know, oh, you know, Iran attacked Israel, and so all the stocks have gone down, and I need to go sell. Like that's how it feels when you're in some of these environments. And so having a very strong, okay, I'm, you know, here's my plan and we're going to focus on these three things. And when this happens, then we can change direction, right? There has to be a specific catalyst for that to happen. Mm-hmm. Then I'm going to sell my stocks. I'm not going to sell my stocks out of fear and greed. But again, it's the reason I say it reminds you of that because it's a very emotional process as well. Mm-hmm. You know, your job could be on the line, your company, your reputation. So a lot of is at stake when you're making some of these calls. And you also have a budget and people, you know, as a security leader or a CIO, you have this budget and you have people who are relying on you and have trusted you with their careers. So carrying the weight of all of that and you know, and making decisions as to where to deploy these resources, having a strong thesis and believing it and testing it. And also just, I think this is why some of these CISO communities are so powerful or CIO communities, because going it alone is impossible.
Exactly. Yeah.
You need somebody to validate, you know, that yes, you're not off the rocker here. Like this is a good plan. Let you know, I did this. So there's a lot of, I'm very thankful to a lot of fellow CISOs who sometimes have just, you know, been struggling with a decision, but just hearing somebody else, you know, just even if it's just a very yep, that you're on the right path. Can help you show up better in the workplace.
Yeah, it does make that community, CIOs included, but CISOs are the most collaborative executive I've ever seen. CFOs are not getting together and be like, hey, what's working out for you, Betsy? You know, hey, what's not? You know, VP sales are not doing that. Heads of products are not. I mean, they have smaller communities. I'm not saying that they're void of that. There's nothing like the CISO community. It works both to the advantages of companies and the disadvantages of companies, by the way. If you have the wrong narrative out there about your search, for instance, that's not going to go over well in the community. But But it is pretty incredible. So, and by the way, I know we're sensitive to time. I know we wanted to get into the CIO CISO convergence where we started. So I can steer us back there. We'd love to hear.
Go for it, Michael. You want me to steer it? I'll take it from here.
You go ahead and steer. It's your ship.
My turn. Yeah. So I think we all had slightly different perspectives on the relationship between CIO and CISO. And we talk about the groups being separate. I don't know, are there combined CIO, CSO communities that join forces? I guess the big question, Betsy, is kind of what's your view of that relationship? How have you seen it succeed in examples that you've been part of? And I think those two things to start.
Yeah, no, that's great. How have I seen it succeed? So I'll give you an example from my two previous roles. As you mentioned earlier, when I was at Butterfly, I owned both the IT and the security functions. Now, at the time, this was a small startup, so we didn't have this ginormous budget. But what I was, so I got the chance to bring in a director of IT, and what was very important for me is making sure that the person that I brought in actually understood security and understood. So in my search for that leader for that function, I over-indexed because I knew at the time that I was at that company, the challenges that we had were more of a security bent versus a if I'm putting on a CIO hat, your main role is to make sure that organizations can reach their goals through technology, and you're enabling them. When I joined Butterfly, my main mandate or my main function was to ensure that we could scale out the business geographically, but the main focus was not on what technology we're going to bring in to help enable, because it was a startup. And so they had, your basic startup package. And so I knew it was going to be a long time until we needed to invest heavier in the CIO side of the house and building out operations and scaling those out. And so that's, in that situation, the person that I brought in was actually very, at the time, the IAM we were using, they were very familiar with it. They had deployed it somewhere else. And so they knew all the pitfalls, and it felt like a very natural fit. And so I think depending on the company and the size and where they are on their journey, it makes a difference of whether you want to have one leader or have two leaders. Now, if you're in a broader giant organization, there's more than enough work for two leaders. And so I'll tell you what I did when I got Chainalysis. Very similar as when I started off at Butterfly, where I brought in a director, because at the time it was, okay, let's get we already have our starter pack of applications and everything is SaaS, right? There's no on-prem. But as I noticed the portfolio of applications starting to get bigger, and some of the business processes that we were building out, hire to retire, order to cash, procure to pay. Now you're starting to get to the point where you need to have somebody who understands how to build out and in what order, and to sit with your sales leaders and sit with your HR leaders. And I quickly looked around and realized that in order for us to meet the goals that we had for Chainalysis, that I needed to bring in a more strategic leader. I can do blocking and tackling all day, every day. You have me deploy Workday, I will do it. I don't know if it's going to work beyond the first 6 months that I set it up, but it will be done. But I knew in order for us to get to that next level and our scale goals that we needed somebody strategic. And so I actually made the case, and I hired equivalent of a CIO there, and actually Michael helped with that search. And so, brought in a really incredible person who was able to, have these conversations that I couldn't have, because I just don't have that background. And so there is a specific skill set, and very, very much so on the CIO side, is from my observation, you know, helping to build out operational processes, you know, helping to sit down and talk to business leaders to say, you know, what are our next 2 to 3 year plans, and how can I help with, you know, how can I bring, what technology can I bring in to help us to meet those goals? And then figure out what some of the pitfalls might be of you know, making the wrong call. So there's, I think, you know, these two roles, depending on where the company is or along the journey or the size, there's room for two strategic people, but they have to work together because there's a gray area. There's, I feel like every company or every time I'm talking to a CISO, there's like, security should own Okta or whatever, insert IAM name here. Or, you know, security really should own a subset of these operations because they're so critical to the mission, and the mission is to protect the company. And so I think it really depends. That is probably one of the most important relationships, is the CIO and the CISO. The other important relationship is the CISO and the CTO. And the same conversation we're having here about enterprise IT and enterprise security, or, you know, most people refer to as corporate security, I think you can have the same discussion about application or product security, and where do you draw the lines between what the CTO is responsible for and what the CISO is responsible for. And so I think that's one of the things that makes the CISO role so complex, is that it can look very different in every company. And there is no, you bring me a CFO, you bring me a CMO, I kind of know what I'm getting into. If you're a CISO, it's like, well, are you a technical CISO? Are you a GRC CISO? Are you, right? Are you an IT? So there's all of these flavors, and that's fine. That's just where we are as in an industry, and what's worked. I suspect, you know, 50 years from now, when another Michael, Sean, and Betsy are sitting to talk about this, things will be very different, and maybe there'll be, you know, a track, and there'll be, you know, this is what a CISO means. This is what it means to have a CISO in your executive team, and, you know, here are the licenses that they need. And maybe we'll see some more standardization. I don't know. But for now, we're in this, you know, stage where it's a very fluid role, depending on what industry or what company you're talking about.
So I've had this dream and thought, and I think I may have found the guest that's actually lived the dream. We'll see. That security isn't just about the blocking and tackling and the filling the holes and mitigating the risk and delivering data to audits to prove that they did things a certain way, but instead have an opportunity to define the business. And I see that in either if they own it themselves or work hand in hand with the CIO and CTO, where we could say, what are we trying to accomplish as a business? And how do we securely get there versus somebody going off and buying a tech stack and customizing it with some app layer. And then security gets brought in to do the vuln assessments and all the policies and stuff around it. Yeah. I have this vision and dream that's the other is possible, that we can actually lead things. So Michael, Betsy, both of you, thoughts on that?
Well, I was just going to make a point that, my experience, you have two different organizations that enable that level of behavior. It's one that either saw the foresight of hiring and bringing on someone like Betsy, who can again, look beyond and say, what's the business looking to do, and have those conversations, be highly collaborative, and be proactive about it. That is definitely in the minority of the companies that do that, because they have not enabled an environment where that individual came in. What the majority of the environments are is the oh no stage of we've now hit a wall and the business is unfolding to a place where we now have a very specific acute pain point to visit the emergency room, and now I have to hire that kind of person, and it becomes a forced function. That's kind of where we are. As you know, again, it's the maturity model of what does the CISO even do? If more companies understood that there were CISOs that have this amazing skill set, you know, and a blended skill set like a Betsy, like others that are out there, we would get to that point a lot faster. And by the way, I'm not rushing everyone because this chaos and everything is why we're even in business. So, but it's going to take a long time to fix it, right? We don't get called for the easy ones. We get called in the, this all happened with my business. And now I have to get this person in here that's like this magician in every single area. And then you realize, okay, that's really hard because the culture wasn't there to support it. So now we have to understand if the culture is there to support it. But it is wonderful to hear that there are companies that saw this in advance and say, hey, look, we really need to bring in this level of this individual. Yeah, it might be an overhire this month, but guarantee next month, this value is going to pay for itself tenfold. So that's what we see. Yeah.
And actually, that was a big reason why I left. You know, Butterfly is a great company, great product. But when I had a chance to sit with the CEO of Chainalysis, Michael Groniger, and he described the challenges that he was facing in building the company, and he understood the role of security. Mm-hmm. You know, he has a background as an engineer, and so maybe it was a little bit easier in the sense that he's just not a 100% business focused, but he also has a background. But that was a key reason why. Because what I didn't want to do was leave a role and then go into an environment where, you know, yeah, you've been brought in to build out this organization, but there's no budget to do the things that you want to do. So that was one of the things that I was very open about in the interview process. And, you know, I see your vision, I understand your vision, I'm bought in, you don't have to sell me on the company. But what I do need to hear from you is about how this will be resourced. And, you know, we have a growth path here. You know, we're going to move, we're going to, you know, bring these number of employees in. And I think it was easier having lived, you know, hyper growth. So I understand, you know, at some point it's like, there's somebody who described this really well, an ex Facebooker, I forget their name, but it's, when you're in a startup, you know, all of a sudden you've got your Legos and you're building your Legos. And then all of a sudden, you know, you start bringing more people into the organization and you don't want to share your Legos. And then things start to break down because now you have all these people who have been, you know, brought into the company, but they cannot contribute because, you know, people are holding on tightly. I said, I'm not going to be that person. I just want to make sure that there's, you know, enough Legos and that we've planned for what the future of the company looks like. So again, it's, you know, it's a confluence of events, but I think, you know, it's not a standard way of thinking because it can be very expensive, as Michael said, and, you know, earlier, not everyone has the budget to bring in a security executive. Not everyone is ready to have a security executive in the conference room or in the boardroom because we're often the people, you know, as a counterweight. I always find it interesting, you know, when I talk to people who are in marketing or sales, because we see the world very differently. Where they see opportunity, I'm with the lawyers going, but this could happen and that could happen, you know. And so it can, if you get the wrong person in that room, it could also hamper or slow down growth. So it's a very difficult, sometimes can be a difficult process when you're bringing in another risk manager, into that conversation.
Yeah, I feel like a buzzkill half the time I'm talking to clients because I'm like, well, what are we doing in here? Where's the, you know, where's the risk mitigation here? They're like, oh yeah, we haven't gotten that. Well, what about here? What about, they're like, why are you showing me all my vulnerabilities?
It's like, right, well, exactly.
Because I'm doing it nicely, but the candidate is going to come in, is probably not going to be so, they're going to be pretty blatant, you know, about what's going on here and probably won't join your organization if you don't even know where the vulnerabilities are. And here's this, you know, dummy recruiter out here doing it, you know. It's like, no, it's great. Great, great. I love the way you position that. That was really interesting. So.
That's a super, super fun conversation. I don't want to let you go.
But, I know, I could talk another hour.
It can be hours.
But we are at the marking point here. I'm going to leave this one question for you, and then Michael can do the final closing with his thoughts. If there's one thing you think we need to do, Betsy, to redefine cybersecurity for the next couple of years, what would that be?
Oh my goodness.
easy question.
If I knew, right? If I knew the answer, that I would be probably fairly wealthy right now on a beach. You know, when I think about where we are in terms of technology growth, and I think about everything that's happening now and is going to happen over the next 10 years, I'm talking about, you know, we started off with social, mobile, cloud, big data. Now we're talking about AI, you know, we're talking about EVs, we're talking about IoT, robotics, biotech. You know, we're seeing a lot of really interesting disruption. I haven't even talked about AGI, but I also don't know what artificial general intelligence really is. I don't think anybody does at this point. But all of these things are happening, and we're in a really, I think, interesting time. You know, we'll look back at this in history, and maybe Michael will write a book about it. But there's an opportunity for security folks to step up and help to lead some of these conversations, because sometimes I think if you look at a problem hard enough, it can become a security problem. So when COVID hit, we had to figure out how to get people to work securely from their homes. And so if there was anything we could do, going back to your question, I think it's more of just trust our security leaders and listen and give them an opportunity. You know, if there's somebody here who's listening and, you know, you're a C-level and you've got security folks in your org, you know, we tend to sometimes, maybe we can overthink the bad things that are going to happen. But even within that space, you know, there's a grain of truth that we should be confronting around all of these technologies that are going to change the way we live, the way our children live. And so a lot of security people I know are very passionate about what they do. It's a hard job, but it's a noble job, because at the end of the day, you have a real world impact. And so I just, you know, talked a lot there. I don't know if there's anything more I can say there, but it's more of just, you know, listen and resource these teams.
Yeah, I'll answer your question, Sean. Or at least I'll give you an answer of how to get 80% of the way there. And actually, Betsy just said it. You know, four things. One, remember that everyone has something going on, right? And it's probably bad. Or, you know, there's things that are bad in people's lives. Two, there's things that have happened and their experiences that shape the way that their decisions are being made. You know, biases and things. That's just human nature. It's what makes us human, right? Three, just listen to everyone, right? I think we'll be a much better security community and the community that works with the security leaders. If we just all listen to one another and you know, don't let our egos get in the way would be the last thing. I think there's a lot still out there. There's a lot of people that think they know more than others and need to show it all the time. And it's just, you know, just connecting on a human level. I think it sounds kind of hokey, but that'll get us 80% of the way there. Cause the world's getting more complex. It's getting more serious. Mm-hmm. We just have to all listen to one another. Like pandemic was a great example. We got so much, we progressed so much further in security because there was this desire to listen to the few people in the organization that knew what they were doing. And there was a lot of progression. And I feel like we've kind of slid backwards a little bit here, but it's there. I mean, the proof is there. So anyway, that's my philosophical words of the day.
I agree. 100% +1, +1, +1.
I love it. This was such a pleasure. I've been wanting to do this with Betsy and yourself for a long time. So thanks for having us, Sean.
This is great. Thank you both. Fantastic conversation. And hopefully people do number three, listen to this and embrace each other. And yeah, I really enjoy this. You're welcome back anytime, Betsy, of course, and Michael. Looking forward to the next one we get scheduled as part of the CISO Circuit series. Great. And yeah, thanks everybody for listening, watching. Please do comment, share, subscribe, follow Betsy, follow Michael, and we'll see you on the next Redefining Cybersecurity podcast.
Thank you.
Be well.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Redefining Cybersecurity podcast with Sean Martin. Please take a moment to rate the show and leave a comment. And remember to share the Redefining Cybersecurity podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues. Come back for more conversations and follow Sean Martin as he continues his journey towards redefining cybersecurity.